Thank you, Dr. Patterson. It's such a pleasure to be here. My apologies for being a few minutes late. I know some of you observant ones might think, well, that's because Tammy's not here and I cannot survive on my own very well. It's probably a lot of truth to that. Actually, she's out of town. But no, you think I'd be doing this long enough that I'd look to make sure there's not like a 20-minute delay at the border due to construction getting here. So next time I'll be smarter. But it is a pleasure to be celebrating this Sabbath with you. This world is built around the philosophy that achieving brings happiness. You know, whatever the goal is, our lives will be better, would be happier when we reach the target. You know, our bookshelves, and the bookshelves, I should say, are filled with self-help books. How do we achieve happiness? We find ourselves making this statement, I would be happy if only fill in the blank. My family would be much better off if only fill in the blank. Lately, I've been spending a fair amount of time, maybe too much, listening to podcasts when it comes to retirement. And I'm chatting with Tammy about the things I'm hearing and learning. And at one point in time, about a month or so ago, Tammy says, you know what, you're starting to get on my nerves. So we think, you know, if we'd be better off if we only achieve such and such. So as always, we look to God's word to guide us on how we should live our lives, including being happy. Turn to Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11. Actually, let's begin in verse 10. Philippians 4 and verse 10. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at least you have received your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak from want, but I have learned to be content in whatever circumstance I am in. So today I would like to ask the question and discuss the question, are we in the state of contentment? And if you're looking for a title, it could simply be, are we content? Are we content? The Greek word for content in Philippians 4 is from the, it's from autarkēs, I should say. The Greek word is autarkēs, that is translated content. And if you're looking for a definition, because it's always important to understand the intent, sometimes the Greek word, the meaning, what it applies, it's sufficient for oneself, strong enough or processing, enough to need no aid or support independent of external circumstances, contented with one's lot, with one's means. In essence, one is content when one feels that they have enough. They have enough. They do not need any additional external circumstance to make them whole. And Paul was in this state. He wasn't wealthy. He wasn't living high on the hog. He had a lot of physical challenges, and he described himself as being in this state. It is good for us to be content. So how can we be in that state? I would like to break it down into two major topics, maybe two major portions of it. First, those things which take us away from being content. And then secondly, what can we do to build our contentment? So first, let's talk about the danger zone. Let's talk about the danger zone. What keeps us? What holds us back from being content? Let's look at Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20. I'll refer to it. I don't know if you need to turn there because I'm only going to refer to one of the commandments. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. It's interesting, because in giving the commandments, you've got, you know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, and needless to say, none of us doubt the seriousness of those commandments. And if you went down the street and say, hey, you shouldn't kill, we agree with you. But then, you know, God adds, it includes the commandment, thou shalt not covet. So it's kind of interesting. I think it underlies the seriousness of the importance of not being in that state where you have to covet, to be in that state where you are coveting, where you're saying, I want more, I have to have more. You know, there's a story of, I don't know if it's true or not, but I like it, so I'm going to pass it on. Abe, and he's not around to confirm. So Abe Lincoln was walking down the street one day with his two sons, both of whom were crying. And what's the matter with your boys? The passerby said. And Lincoln responded, exactly what is wrong with the world? I have three walnuts and each boy wants two. It's you got to have more to be happy. Let's look at Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12 and verse 15. Luke chapter 12, and we'll actually begin in verse 13. Luke 12 and verse 13, someone in the crowd said to him, Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me. But he said to him, Man, who appointed me a judge or arbitrator over you? Then he said to them, Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. Even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possession. Coveting is very dangerous. It leads us to make decisions and to take action that is contrary to God's will. And we see examples in the Old Testament, whether it be, you know, King Ahab winning his neighbor's vineyard, whether it be King David who was coveting Bathsheba. We could turn and read examples of actions and coveting that led to actions that obviously were contrary to God's way. And we may think, well, this is an extreme example of coveting. See, I haven't taken over anyone's neighbor, or I haven't killed a man seeking his wife, and so you're being a little extremist here. And so we may think this is extreme, but it is an example of, even though extreme, of the decisions that we can lead to, or that we can be led to, if we're thinking we have to have more. If we have to have more, you know, it's okay for me to justify some decisions in a career because I need to be able to take that next step. So if I want to take that next step and I want to have more because I want to provide more for my family, you know, even if it puts you in a position where, in the long run, it's harmful for your family, is it best for you? You know, human nature is consistent. Coveting has an effect on us, even for events or for issues that are not as significant as murder or theft of a vineyard. You know, there are companies that have made an art of marketing. And you think Nike and Disney. They have it to a science. They understand the psyche. They understand human nature. They understand what makes people tick. And they're able to put it in such a way that it entices and leads people, starting with young kids, that I'm not happy until. It's interesting to when we were rearing our kids, McDonald's and Happy Meals. Even by the term Happy Meal, if you eat this meal, you're going to be happy. Thankfully, that phase didn't last very long for them. They kind of realized that they didn't like the food very much, which was really good for us, because then we'd have to stop saying, no, we're not going to McDonald's. But it shows you the strength of the marketing. Let's look at Matthew chapter 4. So it's interesting that based upon science, based upon observation, you get companies out there that understand the concept in human nature. It is built within us as human beings. Matthew chapter 4 and verse 1, we read of the ultimate temptation. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he then became hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Then the devil took him into the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple. And he said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you. And on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not strike your foot against the stone. Jesus said to him, on the other hand, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. And again the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give you if you fall down and worship me. And then Jesus said to him, go, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. And the devil left him, and behold, the angels came and began to minister to him. Satan understands human nature, to the point, he, knowing that Jesus was man, was working that angle. Jesus tried to get Jesus in a coveting mood, not only with the physical bread, but a demonstration of his power and the ability to be the ruler of the world at that time. This is something that is part of us. It's part of our human nature. It is part of our makeup, which is why I believe such emphasis. There is one of the Ten Commandments that says, you shall not covet. And it is something that we should be quite aware of. And it's important to remember that coveting can be a problem. Coveting can be a problem, or can be an issue that is not related to the physical. So you think about, thou shalt not covet your neighbor and neighbor's wife and the ox. But coveting also can relate to spiritual things or non-physical things. I'd be happier if I would only be a better singer or a better speaker. Or I could do this, or I could do more. I would like to do more in the church, if only that Mr. Shaw would have used me in this way instead of that way. Or we think about in our past, our history as a fellowship and as a church, going back many, many decades, that we have to have a campus and look how great we are because we have this beautiful college, and Ambassador College. And once again, I'm not trying to minimize the importance of education and preparing our youth and preparing ministry. It's vital to our work. I'm not trying to minimize the decisions around, but it's almost like the college took on a life of its own, and it was almost an idol per se to some. And to the point that there was two tiers. If you went to Ambassador College or if you didn't go to Ambassador College, as an example, and how important and how good you were. Maybe I'm playing it up a little bit, but not maybe not too much. So the whole question around coveting is critical for us when we're thinking about contentment. Let's turn to one final scripture on this section. Let's go to James chapter 4. James chapter 4. James chapter 4 and verse 1. We read, "What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source of your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot attain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think that the Scripture speaks to no purpose? His jealousy desires the Spirit, which he has made to dwell in us. But he gives a greater grace. Therefore, it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble." So in summary, the enemy of being content with what we have is coveting what we don't have. It's coveting what we don't have. So now let's turn to the second part of our discussion of being content. What can we do, as Paul did, to be content in the state in which we find ourselves? What can we do? So it's important to know what we should not be doing, but also what do we do? So a few points related to this. First is that we must set our heart on better things. We must set our heart and therefore our mind on better things. So let's look at Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3. In verse 1, Colossians 3 and verse 1, "Therefore, if you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on earth." So, to not set our minds on the happy meals of this world, but on the full sustenance of God. Now, this may sound a bit simplistic. It's easy to gloss over. But do we really understand what our heart is set on? You know, what really consumes our time and our passion? There's one thing that I appreciate in Stephen Covey, who wrote the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. He built a book that even though it was not a religious book, it was built upon scriptural premises and things that are we would read in the Bible. And one of the things that he focused on, one of the habits, was a time of reflection. And he talked about the weekly cycle. Of course, we know it to be the Sabbath, and while we're here, and to reflect on God's ways. But he emphasized in his point, and it was effective. And this book, it's interesting because, it's, once again, not a religious book, but it is by far the best-selling business book on the face of the earth, because it uses a lot of these sound principles. And when we talk about a time of reflection, he talked about a time of reflection, and one of the habits was a time of reflection, of stopping and reflecting on the previous week. What went wrong? What went right? What should I do different this coming week? And for us, once again, it's the Sabbath. But the point is, it's more than just not working. Our need to reflect and to think and to meditate and to absorb what God is instructing us, what we maybe did so well this past week and not so well this past week. And it's setting our minds on better things. Let's look at Matthew chapter 6 and verse 19. And it's setting aside time to do it. Once again, it's more than just not working. It's setting aside that, you know, that you want to get up at a certain time on the Sabbath morning, and you just want to separate yourself away from everything. Go for a walk, sit out on the porch, find a nice quiet corner of the house, and just reflect and think. Matthew 6, verse 19. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. And let's also look at 1 Timothy chapter 6. Chapter 6 and verse 17. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. Now, some may read these scriptures and think, therefore, having stuff, having wealth, having some shekels in the bank account is a bad thing. No, that's not the case. That's not what the scriptures say. It is not wrong to have wealth. As a matter of fact, if you think of a couple of individuals, the patriarchs, that were probably considered more wealthy than most anyone else on the earth at the time, Abraham and Job, both of them were accounted to having a very strong relationship with God. So there's nothing wrong with having wealth. There's nothing wrong with having a good worth ethic, or having a good savings, or living within your means, or expanding what you do have, because, and once again, that's scriptural, but it is a question around emphasis. It's a question around, where is your heart? Where is your focus? If it's to the point that the only thing you're reflecting on is how many shekels you have in your account, or in my case, how many shekels will you have in your account when you want to retire in roughly 95,580 hours. Not like I'm taking it to extreme or anything like that. But if that's all we think about, if that's what's all in our heart, then we need to think, is it misplaced? It's good to think about retirement. It's good to prepare for retirement. It's good to plan. It's good to do those things. But if that's all consuming, and then secondly, once again, if that's consuming us to the point where now we start making decisions in our lives that are contrary to a support of God's will and bringing many sons to glory, then we have a question. And the other thought around, you know, where do we set our hearts, and where is our heart to contentment? Because we talk a lot about the physical things, but I think it's also to reflect on what we're putting in our hearts from what's coming from around us. And what I mean by that is, you know, especially as we observe the gladiator arena known as American politics, and especially as we come up on another election cycle, aren't we all looking forward to that? It's oftentimes that we as Christians, we maybe can get too caught up. In if we find ourselves that a lot of our discussions at churches, did you read this, Fox article about, what they had to say about Joe Biden, or did you read this CNN article about what they had to say about Trump, or MSNBC, or this wonderful, I get daily rehash of all of the news outlets that fit into my viewpoint of what's going on in the world, and you're just consumed and consumed and consumed. It also, once again, maybe a time to think, where's my heart? What am I filling my heart with? What am I filling my mind with? Yes, it's important to know what's going on. Yes, it's important to be awake. But are we taking it to the extreme? Is that our happy meal? Is that our what's feeding us? So point number one, once again, is to set our mind and our heart on better things. Second point for us to remember is that when we talk about contentment, I'm talking about Paul's use of the term content, autarkes. Contentment is not always joy. Contentment does not always equal joy. Speaking of words and how their meanings are derived, if we think about happy and the English word happy, it comes from the root of hap, or happenstance. And it deals with, in essence, I would say luck. Luck. In other words, if good things happen to you, you good happenstance, oftentimes it leads to happiness. Or if bad things happen to you, it's sad. So maybe I shouldn't use the term luck, but time and chance would be a better application or better use, what I meant to say. So happy does not equal contentment. And contentment does not equal happy. It's a completely different topic. And yes, we can be happy. A lot of good things are happening. Get a lot of, joy in our hearts. And happy does not equal contentment. Let's look at John chapter 16 and verse 33. Let's expound this thought a bit further. John chapter 16 and verse 33. John chapter 16 and verse 33. Jesus instructs his disciples, and it's recorded for our benefit as well, that these things I have spoken to you so that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but take courage, I have overcome the world. Jesus' warning was there will be tribulation. There will be tough times. Difficult is the way. As much as we would like to be able to, flip the switch, hit the easy button, take the blue pill or the green pill or whatever it is, we know that there will be challenges. Let's look at Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2. And let's read the message to the church at Smyrna. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 8. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the first and the last who was dead and has come to life says this, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. But do not fear, but you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be tested, and you will have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death. We could turn to many different scriptures where it talks about the difficulty and the challenges of leading the Christian life. I would love to say it's all about happiness, happenstance, good happenstance. If we revisit the definition of contentment that Paul used in Philippians 4, it is not an expression of joy or utopia, but being sufficient, not needing additional physical items or external stimuli. Sometimes we are challenged. Sometimes we go through trials. Grieving does not have to conflict with contentment. Being in a state of sadness does not conflict with a state of contentment. Being in trials and grieving can often be helped and supported being in a state of contentment. Let's look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Second Corinthians twelve and verse nine. And he has said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness." Quoting once again, Jesus Christ there, it's in red. "Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may dwell in me." Struggles, as much as we don't enjoy them per se, but they can help us to focus on God. When we go through physical challenges or spiritual challenges or deaths or loss of once again, feeling anything that's valuable to us in essence, it can lead to a fair amount of despair. It can challenge us. The question is can we look for those things that will help us to focus on our contentment, saying that, I have the miracle of conversion. I have an understanding of what God's plan is. We could probably take turns being up here at the lectern sharing some recent struggles and challenges. Tammy and I have had ours. And if we can focus on what God has provided us, God's plan of salvation, his promise of grace, and that he will never leave us, we can, it's like that mountain climber that's looking for something solid to put his anchor in. Doesn't want to fall down the mountainside and something solid. And for us, it's that the mercy of God, it's the love of God, it's God's plan, it's his plan of salvation, it's his ways that we can anchor ourselves into. Contentment is not always joy. The third point, then leading to that, I just kind of briefly mentioned it, is that we need to actively then appreciate what we have. We need to actively appreciate what we have. Actively use what God has blessed us with. Once again, this can be rather simplistic, but the key word is actively. Actively. As part of that reflection, as part of that, what do we fill our heart in? You know, is it, are we filling our heart with the woe is me and how much we don't have? Or is it what God has blessed us with? I'm reminded of a story that a professor, he's the dean of admissions at an Ambassador way back when, a gentleman named Dr. Lynn Torrance. Now, Dr. Torrance was quite the character. He was actually in World War II and survived the Bataan Death March. So he had seen quite a bit. And once again, he was quite the character. He, after losing his second wife to cancer, he lost his first wife to cancer, and then he lost his second wife to cancer. He shared in a message he gave about being full of despair. You know, why? What have I done? Why do I deserve this? You know, why have I lost the second love of my life? And started. He got in his car and started driving. Started driving. Dealing with suicidal thoughts, and he said he pulled over and pulled out his notebook, had a pen, and started writing down everything that he was thankful for, everything that God had blessed him with. And he said it was life-changing for him, or it was mind-changing for him in that where he was headed down a path that he didn't know where he was going to end up because it was not healthy, to a point of kind of reflecting once again on God's promise. And he doesn't promise us a life without pain, but he does provide us quite a bit. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5 through 6. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? You know, by focusing on the negatives, it can have a substantial impact on our lives and the lives we encounter. We have a family friend that my brothers and I would often joke that if you gave them $1 million, they'd complain that it was in 50s instead of $100 bills. And it seems like some certain personalities can be like that. It's like you're always looking for what's wrong as opposed to what's right. And I want to be careful here. That doesn't mean that you should never, you know, share your thoughts and feelings. It doesn't mean that you should never, as a Christian, you should never struggle. No, we do struggle. We do struggle. We battle human nature, and there are times that we just need to communicate in our despair. But the question is what do we focus on? What do we appreciate what we have? Or do we focus on what we don't have? Let's look at Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 15. Proverbs 15:15, all the days of the afflicted are bad. You know, woe is me, Eeyore. Nothing goes right. But a cheerful heart has a continual feast. You bring your feast with you. You bring your joy or contentment with you. Let's look at Matthew chapter 6. Some people say, well, you know, they're just lucky. You know, they're lucky individuals. You know, that they've been blessed with this or blessed with that. That's why they're always in such a good mood. You don't know what people deal with and battle with in their personal lives often. You don't know the challenges, and I'd be very careful of putting that on someone. Oftentimes, it's a merry heart that brings their happiness with them. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 25. Matthew 6, verse 25. For this reason I say to you, do not be worried about your life as to what you will eat or what you will drink, nor with your body as to what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, that they do not sow, nor reap, nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much worth much more than they? And who of you, by being worried, can add a single hour to his life? And why are you worried about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you that even Solomon, in all his glory, clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Do not worry then, saying, what will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear for clothing? For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Now, of course, does this mean that you shouldn't plan, you shouldn't worry? No, obviously you need to put the scriptures together and the Bible together. And what Jesus Christ is saying here is talking about the priority. It's about the worrying. It's about the fear. It's about the anxiety. And God is clearly saying, you know, you have a helper. I have your back. It is difficult at times to focus on the haves to deal with the have-nots. And it's difficult to be a positive influence on our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. Once again, it's easy to say, difficult to do. The key point is to be aware, to be self-aware. If we need help, we ask for help. We ask our Heavenly Father for help. We ask our loved ones for help. We ask, you know, a good friend for help. But the first thing is to be self-aware, to appreciate what we have. Way back in my career, I had the opportunity to travel to India for actually an extensive time. And one day I was chatting with the person I normally dealt with, MK, over in Pune, India. And I'd say, MK, one thing I have to be curious. You know, I've heard stories about India. It's considered a developing country. But in my time here, all I see is joy. I see happy people. I see people who are enjoying life. And he referred me to this study done by the London School of Economics that had a system of defining contentment. And it dealt with, you know, things like family status. It dealt with things like different metrics of family status, of and it's not coming to me now, some of the other metrics, but it was global. It was a global survey of contentment. And he said, guess where the U.S. fell? And I don't remember the exact number, but it was like 30. It's like around 30. So of the list of most happy or content countries in the world, U.S. was like 30. And he said, guess where India fell? Or guess where India falls? And it was like the top five. So you would think, you know, the U.S., with its wealth,
with its resources, with its blessings, with its economy, is right down here, where a third world developing country like India, and it was the things that they valued. And I don't want to spend a lot of time now for the sake of time, but the whole point there is that in the U.S., it's like, I got to have, I got to have, I got to have, I got to have. And where in India, they knew. They appreciated what they had in their family structure and how they approached their culture. It's a question around, do we bring our happiness with us? One other quick story related to that is growing up, I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, and as a teenager, I remember specifically there's this lady named Ida Mae Wilson. Now, Ida Mae was struck, I believe it was polio, so she was confined to a wheelchair. She was blind. At the time, she was roughly, if I remember right, about 65 years old. And so she couldn't read, couldn't do anything. She was, once again, confined. And there was a reading program there where folks would go in pretty much every day. They'd sign up for the list when they could go. They'd go in and spend half an hour with Ida Mae, either reading out of, out of the news, the church's news or the church's publications, or reading from the Bible. We tried to read through the Bible in a year with Ida Mae. And the one thing about Ida Mae is that she had every reason to reflect on what she didn't have. She didn't have her legs. She didn't have her arms. She didn't have her sight. So she had a lot of opportunity to reflect on what she didn't have. But the one thing about Ida Mae, and it was pretty consistent, is that you didn't go to and read to Ida Mae to make her happy. You came away from Ida Mae with joy, because she had that effect. She had that effect. When she talked about, when we read in Proverbs 15:15, is that a joyous person, a joyous heart has a continuous feast. Ida Mae had a continuous feast. So oftentimes when I take the time to reflect and where am I with my contentment, I think about Ida Mae. I think about those who live a continual feast and the impact that they have on others. And I think, what impact am I having on those around me? Do they know how horrible life is? Or do they know how joyous life is? The final point that I wanted to cover quickly as far as for us to develop contentment is that the ability to choose to be content always remains with us. The ability to choose to be content always remains with us. And I wanted to as part of emphasizing this, wanted to reference a book by Viktor Frankl. Dr. Frankl, or Viktor Frankl, for those of you who are not familiar with the name, was actually a member of or a prisoner in a concentration camp during World War II. He was a psychologist as far as a doctor. But this is something he experienced, and he wrote about his experiences in a work called Man's Search for Meaning. And I just wanted to read a few sections from this. Quoting then Dr. Frankl here, is we have stated that which was ultimately responsible for the state of the prisoner's inner self was not so much the causes as it was the result of a free decision. Observations of the prisoners have shown that only the men who allowed their inner hold on their moral and spiritual selves to subside eventually fell victim to the camp's degenerating influences. The question now arises, what could or should have constituted this inner hold? Continuing to quote a couple pages later, a man who let himself decline because he could not see any future goal found himself occupied with retrospective thoughts. In a different connection, we have already spoken of the tendency there was to look into the past to help make the present with all its horrors less real. But in robbing the present of its reality, there lay a certain danger. It became easy to overlook the opportunities to make something positive of camp life, opportunities which really did exist. Now, once again, he experienced it. He was a prisoner. Prisoners lost their hold on life. The prisoners lost their hold on life. Everything, in a way, became pointless. Such people forget that often it is just such an exceptionally difficult external situation which gives man the opportunity to grow spiritually beyond himself. Instead of taking the camp's difficulties as a test of their inner strength, they did not take their life seriously and despised it as something of no consequence. They preferred to close their eyes and to live in the past. Life for such people became meaningless. And one more quote, the prisoner who had lost faith in the future, his future, was doomed. With his loss of belief in the future, he also lost his spiritual hold. He let himself decline and became subject to mental and physical decay. Usually this happened quite suddenly in the form of a crisis, the symptoms of which were familiar to the experienced camp inmate. We all feared this moment, not for ourselves, which would have been pointless, but for our friends. Usually it began with the prisoner refusing one morning to get dressed and wash or to go out to the parade grounds. No entreaties, no blows, no threats had any effect. He just lay there, hardly moving. If this crisis was brought about by an illness, he refused to be taken to the sick bay or to do anything to help himself. He simply gave up. The ability to choose always remains with us. Once again, this statement, it's oftentimes can be easy said, more difficultly done. As individuals, and we think of our own proclivities and our own strengths and our own weaknesses, I believe just as some of us have physical traits that are more pronounced than others, some of us have certain talents that are more pronounced than others. Certain of us have abilities to put up with challenges more than others. We're not all created equal. And it is definitely more difficult for some of us when we read these things and say, I ain't like Dr. Frankel, I'm going to say, this is what I choose. I'm not going to let this external circumstance affect me the way, and this is what I'm going to choose. I believe just because of how God created us, it's easier for some of us than others. And for some of us, it is a challenge. I think that's reality. But that leads us to the points we cover and what the scriptures say and why it's important to reflect, why it's important to constantly be putting the good things in our heart. It's why it's important for us to make sure that we're not coveting, that we are appreciating the good things that we have in life and the blessings that God has given us. It's important for us to ask for help. It's important to do all these things because it is, for some of us, harder work than others. But we have the promises from God that it is achievable. And we have the promises from God that He loves us and that He will not forsake us and that He will not tempt us beyond what we're capable. It's something that we need to hold on to, that promise. It's, through the guaranteed trials of our lives, it is important for us to be in the state of contentment. So let's focus on being content.